Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. This week, I'm going to be talking a little bit more about Britain in the 1970s. Done a little bit on Britain in the 60s previously. But the 70s, for my money, is much more interesting, much more fraught, and much more pertinent decade. It tells us an awful lot about Britain's difficulties throughout the post-war period. The first 4 years of that decade are dominated by Edward Heath, who becomes Prime Minister in 1970, winning a surprise election against Harold Wilson, and being eventually borne down by the miners in 1974. Now, the dominant theme throughout this period will be industrial relations. In fact, there are actually two key themes, that of inflation and that of union unrest. The number of strike days being lost in Britain had mounted over the 1950s and 1960s, and it was in the late 1950s you start to see kind of cultural representations of this with films like I'm All Right, Jack, which, if you haven't seen it, it's a very funny film starring Peter Sellers and Terry Thomas about a union shop floor shop steward who is so belligerent, so small-minded and so petty that he calls the union out on strike at the drop of a hat. What was happening from the 50s and 60s onwards is that as society became more affluent and wealthy, the labour aristocracy, the leadership of the trade unions, had become progressively more and more remote from their rank and file membership, living quite affluent lifestyles. And the rank and file membership looked to the unpaid shop stewards, who very often behaved like little Napoleons on their own lunchtime, who called out wildcat strikes that were not sanctioned by the TUC and really became the tail wagging the dog. They had eventually, by the late 1970s, more power than the union leadership. And it was these shop stewards who, by the late 1970s, had really radicalised and believed they were bringing about a revolution in Britain. They were reading really from Trotsky and that sort of thing. And they had, obviously, extensive relationships with the far left in Britain at the time. But we need to go back a pace. By the late 1960s, Harold Wilson had realised that successive devaluations of the pound had derailed his plan to spend lots of money modernising Britain, reforging Britain, as he said, in the white heat of technology. Much of that was rhetoric anyway. It was a way of distinguishing this new modern kind of Labour Party from the old, as he put it, the grouse moors and tweeds of the Conservatives. By the early 1960s, all things working class, from the Beatles through to the kitchen sink dramas of people like Alan Sillitoe, were hugely popular. And people like Alec Douglas Hume, the Prime Minister whom Wilson beat, and Harold Macmillan, the Prime Minister before him, had seemed hopelessly anachronistic, and the old-school tie of the Etonians and Harrovians that dominated the Conservative Party was seen as very much a thing of the past. Wilson claimed to really be looking to sweep all this away. How much sweeping he did is questionable, but ultimately the technological future he planned for Britain was largely a rhetorical one. By the late 1960s, this is not happening. Britain is no more an industrial powerhouse or a high-tech economy than it was in 1964 when Wilson came to power. In fact, countries like West Germany and Japan are streaking ahead. So instead, Wilson looks to what he sees as the big industrial problem of the time, the growing number of strikes. Now, if you actually look comparatively at Germany, at America, at Japan, Britain is far down the list of strike days lost. And the impact of strike days was more political and cultural than it was economic. There was less damage in the 1960s to the British economy through strike days than one might think. I think we lost 0.5% of all working days in Britain due to strikes in 66 to 68. However, newspapers like the Times particularly, and much of the media, and much of the general public indeed, saw the unions in a progressively less and less sympathetic light. In the 30s and 40s, there had been substantially more support and more sympathy for the unions. But in an age of far greater affluence, in an age of far greater prosperity, the behaviour of the unions was becoming less and less palatable and more disruptive. So by the late 1960s, Wilson believed that it was time to take the unions on. And so he did the brave thing and handed the job to Barbara Castle. Wilson didn't want to be seen to be doing this himself. He was very much testing the waters to see if this would be something he'd get away with. By the late 1960s, of course, Wilson's very suspicious of people like James Callaghan in his cabinet, suspecting that there might be a coup to overthrow him. And James Callaghan's behaviour didn't kind of do anything to allay these fears. The job that Barbara Castle, who is the secretary for, I believe at the time, was Trade and Employment, was given was to come up with a solution to the union problem. So she took her senior civil service team off to the Civil Service College at Sunningdale, and in late 1968, and in January 69, presented Wilson with a report which came to be known as the In Place of Strife report. And it recommended a cooling-off period for the unions if there had been a wildcat strike. So 28 days where people had to go back to work legally and at risk of perhaps losing their jobs, and had to calm down, in essence, and to allow the fiery rhetoric of the shop stewards maybe just to wear off a little bit before seriously taking industrial action. And all of them industrial action had to be balloted. This meant that there would be some curb on union power, but not an excessive amount. The unions rejected it out of hand. Wilson panicked, distanced himself from the report, and Callaghan, speaking up for the unions, which, as we shall see when we look at the Winter of Discontent, is an extremely ironic turn of fate. Callaghan, speaking up for the unions, decided that he was going to sabotage Castle's efforts. And as a result, the one chance to, before the 1970s, to rein in union power is missed. So Edward Heath inherits the problem. Edward Heath was a man who was a good administrator, he was a good organiser, but perhaps the most unsuccessful and uncharismatic British Prime Minister, with maybe the exception of Gordon Brown. The problem that Edward Heath had is that he really was not good at dealing with people, which, as you can imagine, Prime Ministership of Great Britain is that skill is something of a prerequisite. Edward Heath was short, abrupt, famously bad-tempered, and really an appalling communicator. However, he had a vision for Britain, One that he kind of was articulated later at the Selsdon Park conference. In January 1970, before the election, Heath got together his shadow cabinet and political advisers at the Selsdon Park Hotel and planned out a manifesto for Britain. And it was really a kind of proto-Thatcherism. It was about reducing the role of the state, introducing the free market, trade union reform, and most of the things that you can see emerging from 1979 onwards under Margaret Thatcher. The problem with the Selsdon Park conference was that when it eventually came to enacting the manifesto, by 1972, almost every major strand of it had not just fallen apart, but had gone into reverse. Edward Heath actually expanded the size of the state. He was seemingly incapable of expanding the role of the free market in Britain. And certainly by 1974, he completely failed at trade union reform. So how had this happened? Well, I think the answer is this, is that Heath was this curious mixture of the old One Nation Tory, the Harold Macmillan kind of conservative who had existed throughout the post-war era, who believed in a kind of a consensus of a mixed economy, a degree of nationalisation, a commitment to full employment, and a reasonable working relationship with the trade unions. And these were the pillars of the consensus between the Conservative and Labour parties throughout that period. So there's that element to him, but also there is this rather functionalist, technocratic, and driven sort of individual who is convinced by free market and right-wing radicals within the party, who'd existed really since the late 1950s, most notoriously in the guise of people like Enoch Powell, who really pressured for kind of right-wing free market reforms.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And the introduction of monetarism, the contraction of the money supply, the limitation of state spending, and the idea that this was the only medicine really to cure the fundamental problem of inflation. Now, I've mentioned inflation at the start of the podcast. Inflation was something that both parties had agreed in the 40s, 50s and 60s was a necessary evil. The inflation was the price worth paying for full employment. The two parties had long and bitter memories of the 1930s and unemployment then, and they had no wish to repeat that. And the kind of post-war social contract really relied on easy accessibility to work for most of the population. Now, the problem that happens in the 1970s is not only does unemployment go up, but inflation does too. And this seemed to baffle economic thinkers. The idea had been in classical economics that there was a trade-off, that once unemployment went down, the economy would heat up because more people are in jobs, more people are spending, more people are making things, goods and services, and money is whizzing around. This leads to a degree of inflation. And the opposite scenario is lots of people are out of jobs, unemployment goes up, but inflation comes down because money isn't going around as fast, and in an economy with a fixed money supply, when the amount of money in circulation stops circulating at a certain speed, prices will tend to come down. So the original answer to the kind of economic dilemma had been to try to walk a kind of a delicate tightrope between a degree of inflation and a low degree of unemployment. This consensus seems to fall apart in the 1970s, and monetarist economists point to inflation and say, that's your problem. Inflation going up kind of erodes like a cancer the heart of British industry. It makes it less competitive over time. So over time, gradually, unemployment will go up as well. As inflation started to tick up, the British miners, represented by the National Union of Mine Workers, began to feel really that they had been ignored by the successes of the 1960s. By 1970, there had been several decades of consumer expansion. There had been, since really the early 1950s, a consumer boom, and also a boom in home ownership. The swinging 60s hadn't been swinging for most people. You know, most people had not seen the sex, drugs and rock and roll, but they had seen affluence. But the miners particularly felt left out of this. It was still one of Britain's biggest industrial groups and one of the most unionised of all professions, and hadn't had a pay rise since the early 1960s. They were ready to go on strike in the early 70s, and they certainly did, with the first national miners' strike in 50 years in 1972, which threatened to bring the country to a standstill. Now, they managed to have such a devastating effect on the country for a number of reasons. The first was their leadership had shifted to the left, to the more radical and confrontational figure of Arthur Scargill, who was demanding a nearly 50% pay rise for the miners. His tactic of using flying pickets meant that he coordinated groups of miners in the Midlands, in Yorkshire and in Wales to picket collieries, coking stations, power stations and power plants up and down the country and ensure that they stay shut. In doing this, in a coordinated manner, they caused a major threat to the national power production, the production of electricity across the whole of the United Kingdom. And the showdown came at the Saltley coking plant in Birmingham. 2,000 miners picketed the plant, and the police just about managed to hold them back. Scargill then turned to the radical shop stewards in Birmingham at the various engineering works and workshops across the city and arranged for them to call out their workers as well, putting the fear into Edward Heath's mind that there may well be a general strike in the offing. When the police decided they couldn't hold the miners back any longer, the coking plant had to be shut. And this really signified victory in 72 for the miners. Now, it's easy to look at the miners and blame them wholeheartedly. But there's another factor in all of this that needs to be taken into consideration. Edward Heath and his Chancellor, Anthony Barber, had concocted the most incredible boom in 1972, in the 1972 budget, which led to an explosion of inflation at a time when really inflation was ticking up anyway. The furious increase in public spending and the generous entitlements handed out led to a surge in prices, which at a time when the miners were striking for pay that they should have been paid a long, long time ago, really helps us to understand their militancy. Ted Heath at the time was happy to blame the union militancy for the slowdown in the British economy and thus the inflation problem. But really, the problem lies a lot closer to home. The miners were reacting in, you know, a militant but rather predictable manner, unfortunately. Once the strike was successful, Heath came to the negotiating table and agreed to the miners' demands, offering them a 27% pay rise. And the damage done to Heath's prestige was considerable. The next attempt to deal with inflation came a year later, in 1973, when public sector pay cuts were instituted and there were caps on the amount of pay, the level of pay awards that could be given out. All miners were public employees, bar a tiny, tiny few. All miners worked, for the most part, for the National Coal Board since the nationalisation of coal, so they were subject to these pay caps. And the miners decided that once again they would go on strike in order to protect the gains they had made in 1972. The result was that by December of 1973, coal stocks had dwindled and there was not enough coal to power the power stations to keep the lights on. So in December 1973, Heath addressed the nation and told them that there would be, in essence, a three-day working week, and that there would be it would be a more difficult Christmas than many had experienced since the war. The net effect of all of this was that in the short term, Heath's popularity, which was never great, plummeted. By the time of the election in 1974. He attempted a rather risky act of brinkmanship and demanded to know who governs Britain. And the answer from the tabloids, of course, was "not you, mate." And he also took the rash decision of calling a February general election when the three-day week was still in operation. Which was probably something that no other British Prime Minister would have considered doing. The result was a hung Parliament, and he couldn't rely on the support of Ulster Unionists and Liberals in order to keep the Conservative majority, and so it ushered back into power Harold Wilson. But the Harold Wilson who came back into power wasn't the cocky and ebullient Yorkshireman who had swanned into 10 Downing Street a decade earlier. It was a much older, tireder, greyer and less enthusiastic Prime Minister, a man who was fearful almost of what the next few years would hold, and rightly so. Now, there are issues, for the sake of brevity in this podcast, that I'm not going to cover right now, but there are fundamental ones as well. The great achievement of the Heath years, the one that we are fools to neglect, was that Heath took Britain into the European Economic Community. And the other great catastrophe of the Heath years is obviously the escalation of violence of the IRA and the UVF and other parties in Northern Ireland. And the situation in Northern Ireland was exacerbated really by a lot of careless neglect by the British government and an inability really to properly engage with it. And the Wilson and Heath governments are both equally to blame for this. But this is a subject for another time. Heath never again returned to 10 Downing Street, and his kind of famous blood feud with Harold Wilson is one of the kind of the defining features of the period. He looked upon Wilson as a kind of a crook and a fraud, whereas Wilson looked upon Heath really as this kind of rather doctrinaire, rather pompous character. And I always think there are some very interesting parallels between Gladstone and Disraeli on this one. But again, that's a story for another time. Anyway, I hope that's been useful. If you want a really good authoritative history of the Heath years, get Dominic Sambrook's State of Emergency. It's a brilliant, brilliant book, written with his characteristic verve, wit and insight. I can't recommend it highly enough. Anyway, I hope this has been useful to you, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.